This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
After my guest, comic W. Kamau Bell, felt that he wasn't finding his audience in either black or white comedy clubs, he went his own way, doing his show in theaters, talking about race and politics, and his life as a black man married to a white woman. They now have two children. Chris Rock liked his act and helped him get a show of political satire on FX called Totally Biased. Last year, Bell got his own series on CNN called United Shades of America. Now he has a new memoir called The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. The book is about a lifetime of feeling like he doesn't fit in. Perhaps that was especially true when he was a child, trying to fit in each time he moved to a different city. Let's start with a clip from United Shades of America, which has started its second season. It's kind of a travel show in which Bell sometimes goes to places he probably shouldn't go, or that you wouldn't expect him to go. Last season, he went to a KKK rally. This season, in an episode about immigrants, one of the interviews is with Richard Spencer, a white nationalist and co-editor of altright.com. Spencer opposes immigration and thinks our country should be run by white men. Here's a clip from that interview, which took place at a convention in Washington, D.C., sponsored by Spencer's group, the National Policy Institute.
What does it mean to you to be alt-right?
If you were summing it up in one word, I would say it's identity, and that identity is the foundation of everything. And also, I put forward this mantra, race is real, race matters, and race is the foundation of identity. So if I were to ask you, who are you? Mm-hmm. Just don't think about it, just answer.
No. I would say I'm a black man. I would put those two come back to back.
But if you ask a white person, would they say, I'm a white man?
No.
Like, in a way, we want to be as smart as African Americans about identity.
We're happy to help you. So I think white people do need to talk about their whiteness more, and we're here doing it.
We're here to talk about white privilege. We want to bring it back, make white privilege great again.
So you're a fan of white privilege?
Oh, yeah.
What do you love about white privilege?
Oh, it looks great. Like, you know, I mean, the people are good looking and, you know, nice suits, great literature. Like, yeah, I just want to bathe in white privilege, the greatest, most awesome thing.
It's working out for you.
Well, yeah, I want to expand white privilege. We live in a world where every spring, Google and Facebook and Apple release these diversity numbers, and they'll be like, it's amazing, guys, we hired less white men this year. We think that it's inherently wonderful for white people to have less power.
Well, that's Richard Spencer being interviewed by W. Kamau Bell. Kamau, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the new season of your CNN series and on your new memoir. So the last time you were on our show, it was during the first season of your CNN show, United Shades of America, and I played an excerpt of your interview with a Klansman because you did an episode about the Klan. You talked to Klansmen. You went to a cross burning or a cross lighting, as they like to call it. And it was so interesting to compare the Klan interviews with the Spencer interview. And one of the things that stuck out to me is that, you know, this is kind of like postmodern racism, because like Richard Spencer he's ironic when he wants to be. He made jokes when he was talking to you. And in the part when we didn't hear, when you introduce yourself, he says to you, good to see you, my man. What's up? Does that strike you like the difference between like new school and old school, you know, racism?
Yeah, I think the thing is that Richard Spencer is smart about the fact that He's trying to be a star. He's got to be seductive. And that means being able to speak to a person like me. And then I think on some level, Richard Spencer wants to be liked, even by a black guy. And so when he sat down for that interview, he had been doing a lot of media interviews that day with people who I think he felt like he had to be more confrontational with. And my whole energy is like, let's sit down and talk, man. and then he's like, okay, my man. You know, so I think he was really... It's funny. We were really aware that when it was over, he turned to like his people and my people, like, that was good, right? That was good, in a way that you would not expect the Klan to do that.
So, what's your reaction to that? I mean, I know you don't want to give him like a podium just to promote himself. So, like, what outcome were you hoping for when you talked with him?
I've heard the number one pushback that I've gotten on social media is like, why are you giving him a platform? And it was very similar to the pushback I got last year from people on with the Klan episode. Why are you giving them a platform? And for me, it's like, platforms aren't always positive things. You know, the platform sort of is just there to be given to you. And then it's about how you're framed on the platform, what you do with the platform. And I feel like when people say, why are you giving him a platform for his ideas? I feel like what you're saying is you're afraid his ideas are better and more convincing than your ideas. And I'm not afraid of his ideas. I'm afraid of the impact of his ideas. But I think if you put my ideas next to his ideas, which is what we do on the show, and the ideas of other people, it's very clear that the America he's envisioning is not the America most of America wants. But I think many people, still even in the wake of Trump's election, aren't really ready to embrace the fact that at the seed of the base of President Trump is white supremacy. And Richard Spencer is proof that that is the seed of that, because he's, you know, Steve Bannon's in the White House. Richard Spencer is alt right. Steve Bannon's alt right. And so for me, it's like, I think people who are hashtag woke, as we say, forget that most people are not hashtag woke at all. And so what I hear when I put him out there, when we did the Klan episode, when we do this episode, I believe you hear from a lot of people going, I had no idea. And so I feel like that's who the episode is for, people who still have no idea.
Which did you feel more threatened by? You know, the Richard Spencer, ironic, you know, like, good to see you, my man, kind of racism, or the Klan cross-burning kind of racism. And the other thing about it is, like you said, Richard Spencer wants to be a star. The Klan's people are hidden under robes. They don't want you to know who they really are. Mm-hmm. It's just an interesting contrast.
No, I would say it's very easy to make that choice. I was 100% more threatened by the Klan, but ironically, I was more uncomfortable at the Richard Spencer conference.
Because?
The Klan, there was this sense of, like, they were like a core of the guys who were there who sort of were like, again, kind of like Richard Spencer, were like excited to finally be able to talk about the Klan in some sort of way. They were like, I finally get to talk about this. And one guy, it's clear we sort of have a good back and forth. But there was all this sort of people surrounding the Klan where I was like, we're in a forest somewhere in the middle of Kentucky. I don't know what the plan is. You know, I kept envisioning that scene from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where the black guitar player sort of is dragged to the Klan meeting. And I felt like, I don't know if there's something else here that I'm unaware of. So I think the whole time I was there, I was aware of the fact that something could go left really quickly, because the core group of three or four guys who were talking to me are fine. But there's all these other dudes who are here and some women who I feel like hate me. And so I don't know if they're going to suddenly, like, freak out. And then the other side of this is that I was also very aware of the weight of the Ku Klux Klan in the history of this country, and the history specifically of my people. So that there was even though these people weren't necessarily the ones who lynched black people, people like these lynched black people. And so there was this historical weight I carried the whole time with me when I was there. Richard Spencer, it was more uncomfortable because this was connected directly to the White House suddenly, or directly to electoral politics. You know, when we did the Klan episode, there was a sense of, like, we went and found them. With Richard Spencer, he was in D.C. at the Ronald Reagan building. You know, he was sort of claiming his space in the national discussion. And when we booked him, he wasn't really that known. It was like, oh, there's this guy, Richard Spencer. But by the time we went and filmed with him, he had become more known. And then after we filmed, he's even become more known. So it's like, I feel very excited in some sense to get his ideas out there so that other people who think they have a sense of who Richard Spencer is will get a better sense of it. But ultimately, I didn't feel physically threatened at the Richard Spencer conference, I would say. Like, I felt like, you know, the room probably had 200 people in it. And I kind of felt like, if things go bad, I could pretty much Neo my way out of this. Like, it's like 1,000 Agent Smiths and I'll be Neo, sort of like punching the white supremacists while I walk to the door.
So the show is premised in part that if people meet face-to-face, they'll understand each other better. Do you think anyone from the Klan or that Spencer walked away from your interviews thinking, he was such a kind of big-hearted, nice, smart black man. Gosh, I've been wrong all along. Black people are okay.
I think we have a sort of a false notion that people get changed in one conversation, you know. I always blame it on that movie American History X, where Ed Norton's character hangs out with the black guy in the laundry, and over the course of a few clothes folding sessions, they end up going, man, black people are pretty cool. I feel like that, like, we should know by now that it doesn't happen that quickly. So I definitely know that when I went into conversations with people, they walked out thinking differently about me, where they thought differently about black people than they walked in. Like, I think some of them thought they were going to come and get one over on me or intimidate me, and then they walked in going, yeah, I didn't really intimidate that guy. And I also pushed people. Like, I think the biggest surprise I had about the Richard Spencer conference was that there weren't that many women there, and they kind of were okay with that. Like, they were very open about the fact that white men rule America and white men's places at the front of the movements. I talked to a woman there about it, and she was like, okay with it too. She's like, women aren't really the leaders of political movements. And I was like, well, in my people's history, the civil rights movement is filled with women leading the movement. And she said, well, I'll have to look into that. And I felt like, well, good, go look into that. can I talk to you about, does the name Harriet Tubman mean anything to you? So, you know, for me, the racism stuff I was prepared for, the sexism I was totally shocked by.
You've lived in lots of different parts of America over the years. You spent most of your formative years in the North, but summers you'd spend with your father in Mobile, Alabama, and then you spent about 2 years living with him after you and your mother had moved to Chicago, and you didn't much like it there. The private school that you went to is predominantly white. I don't know what the racial makeup of the public school was, but I'm wondering what impact it had on your, you know, in the Richard Spencer part, you identify yourself as a black man. So what impact did it have on your identity as a black boy, because you were a child at the time in school, to be in this private school that was predominantly white and then switch over to a public school that was probably more racially mixed?
Yeah, the public schools were certainly more racially mixed, and sometimes they were mostly black. So I would say that. I feel like there's sort of two things that happened. Like, I remember being at the Park School. I think there was only in my class, there was me and one other black kid. I may be misremembering, but the kid I remember, there was a black kid I talk about in the book named Dana Jackson, who was like, I felt like, as I write about in the book, like it was like meeting Will Smith when he was 12. Like, it was like he was a cool black dude, like had like abs and like chest muscles and, you know, was taller than everybody, had like a mustache at 11. And I remember feeling like this weird, like, I'm not Dana Jackson, that I wish, like, why does he have to be here? Like, if I could, that there's some sense that we're almost competing with each other because we're the only two black people around. And I happen to be going to this private school with one of the, what seems to be one of the coolest black people on the planet. And it was sort of, I was somewhat frustrated by that at the time. And then when I would go to the public school, there was this group pressure that I felt. Suddenly it became very clear to me that the culture I consumed, the movies I watched, the fact that I stayed up late night to watch late night talk shows so I could see comedy, the fact that I wasn't listening to hip hop and R&B, like all my, that suddenly I felt like I wasn't doing blackness the right way. That in the private school, I didn't feel the same expectation of how to be black. I weirdly felt it more when I was in the school with around mostly black people, about like, because there's this sort of like, you know, we're talking about when I was in school, Michael Jackson is huge. You know, the hip hop is really, is the birth of hip hop is really happening in a major way. It's going mainstream. And I was a big fan of Michael Jackson. You know, you couldn't be 11 in 1984 like I was and not know all the songs on Thriller, but he wasn't my favorite thing, you know? And so for me, it was like suddenly the being in the schools with it, where it's mostly black kids, I suddenly felt this pressure of like, I'm not, and I didn't have this thought process, but I just felt like I'm not being black correctly. I better just be quiet. So when people start talking about hip hop, I better just shut up and nod along. I'm not going to try to pretend like I know, although sometimes I did, but like, you know, sort of like, cause I'm not taking this stuff in. It doesn't hit me the same way.
So let's talk about comedy. You loved comedy when you were a kid. You kind of wanted to be a comic. You had no idea how to get there from here. So you went to the University of Pennsylvania. You dropped out, moved back to Chicago, lived with your mother for a while, and then started doing open mic sessions in Chicago. And this was after, I think, your mother had enrolled you at Second City, which is a pretty cool thing for a mother to do. That's pretty smart, right?
Yeah, no, I have the greatest mom of all time, period, to steal a title from my Denzel Washington podcast. Yes, see, my mom is definitely... She's on the Mount Rushmore of moms. And other people who meet her put, like yeah, I wish I had your mom. So, yeah, she knew I love Saturday Night Live. She knew people from SNL came out of Second City. We were in Chicago. It's on the north side of town. Just take the bus there. I've enrolled you in classes at Second City. And it was just sort of like and I was in the middle of, I just dropped out of college. I'm watching, like, you know, the LA riots on TV. I'm feeling like, what am I doing with my life? And it's just like, okay. It was like, get a job and go to class at Second City. Like, it was just like the two things I had to do. Yeah.
So when you started doing open mic nights, you were doing them at predominantly white comedy clubs and predominantly black comedy clubs, which, as you point out in your memoir, had really different styles in addition to really different audiences. Can you compare what was happening at both of those clubs? Both of those kinds of clubs?
Yeah, I started stand-up in 1994. So we're talking about the height of Def Jam comedy, like the Def Jam movement from HBO, Russell Simmons, HBO's Def Comedy Jam. And so black comedy, which had been an underground phenomenon, becomes mainstream on HBO. And it becomes a thing that, like, all these black clubs open up. And it becomes a thing that now we can, that as a mainstream culture, we can identify a thing that's called black comedy. You know, before that, you're talking about, you know, you got Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby, who are very different, but are sort of both considered to be black comedians. But now there's a thing that's called black comedy. And so a lot of black comedy rooms open up, rooms that are catering to black audiences, which is great because those audiences didn't have those rooms before. So in Chicago, a club opens called All Jokes Aside, which is a black comedy club. But I started doing comedy on the north side of Chicago, which is the whiter side of town. And it's again, in America, we don't say white. We just sort of say regular. Like, so these are just, they're white rooms, but they're not broadcast as that. It's just a coffee shop where mostly white people are at, or a bar where mostly white people hang out. So I find myself in these situations where if I go on stage in these white open mics and talk about racism, first of all, I wasn't funny. Let's be clear about that. But I could just feel the fact that there was a little bit of, yeah, I always want to put it like, it's not like I was too edgy for the room. Well, part of it, but also I was not funny. So there's a sense of like the audience is sort of like, do I believe his experience? Is this true what he's saying? Is he making this up? And so I'm having to sort of fight for what I'm sort of trying to say. This is the truth. I'm having to fight for the premise and not fight for the punchline.
But oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to fight for like, can we all agree that these are the facts of the situation? And that's what a premise of a joke is. You have to get the audience to buy into the facts as you're laying them out. Even if the facts are ridiculous, you have to get them to buy in. But if they don't buy the premise, the punchline doesn't matter. The punchline can't be big enough if they don't buy the premise. And so then I didn't spend a lot of time in the black comedy club because even walking in there, it felt like it's like a little bit like public school on, you know, but grown up. it's like these are the same kids who when I was a kid were sort of like, I felt like I was being made fun of because I wasn't listening to the right music or I wasn't being a black man in the right way. And now they're all adults and they're drinking and they want the show they've seen on HBO. They want the Def Jam show. And I would watch those shows. And let me be clear, those shows are amazing and they're powerful. And the performers really give it all to the audience. They don't leave anything on the floor. It's a very athletic experience. Whereas in white comedy clubs, a lot of times you can just stand behind the mic and not move. You can't really get away with that, especially at that point in black comedy. You couldn't really get away with that. And so anytime I would sort of find myself going on stage in these places, it was just very clear to me that, like, it was very clear to me and the audience that, like, that you're not doing this the way we want it. And I'm not going to say right or wrong, but you're not doing this the way we want it. And so I sort of got my feelings hurt quite often in a way that I didn't get my feelings hurt. When white audiences didn't think I was funny, I was like, well, they didn't think I was funny. But when black people didn't think I was funny, it was like it hurt my soul. Like, it really, like, it just, so it became a thing where I was like, well, I'm just not going to go over there. And then it feels weird that you can't perform in front of black people or you're afraid of it or you turn down gigs that every other black comic you know is doing. And then I would meet other black comedians who felt the same way, but it was like a secret. Like, I struggle in black comedy rooms too. It was like an AA meeting, a black comedy meeting. Like, you know, hi, my name's Kamau, and I struggle at All Jokes Aside. Hi, Kamau, we love you. and then as I moved to the Bay Area and I started working different things, I would sort of just really start to go, it's okay that I can't do those rooms. And anytime I would do them, you know, the worst than bombing in a comedy club, Terry, people don't realize this, is actually just doing mediocre. There's something beautiful about bombing. Mediocre is horrible. It's like people will tell the story of a comic who bombed big enough, you know, but when you just do sort of kind of okay, nobody tells that story.
Right, because it means people are kind of indifferent to you.
Yeah, they're just totally indifferent. They just like, people think the scariest thing is being heckled. No, the scariest thing is when people just turn to the people at their table and go, anyway, what do you want to talk about while you're on stage? which I had happen on many occasions. And again, it was like, I would struggle with like, well, this just isn't my room. And also it hurts my soul that I can't connect with my people. And so ultimately I went to go find my audience. And now there are black people in my audience, but they sort of came to me specifically as opposed to just, you know, walking into a black comedy club.
So we've talked before about what it's been like for you to have a white girlfriend who is now your wife and to have a child and now two children. And there's just like so many misunderstandings from strangers, you know, that have this, you know, kind of like beneath the surface racist assumption behind it. So I know you've been through a lot of awkward stuff. I wonder, as your children get older, how are your concerns about what they're facing changing? Because like when your child is an infant, your child isn't out in the world by themselves and they don't have to have like an identity. They get a little bit older, they have to deal with that kind of stuff. So how old are they now?
My oldest daughter is seconds away from being 6 years old. I mean, not literally, but she'll be six very soon. And my youngest daughter is 2.5.
Okay, so your youngest daughter isn't really dealing with that kind of stuff yet.
No, but she's still in the world and she's still dealing with stuff. Whether she realizes it's happening, I see her having to deal with the fact that she doesn't look as much like me as people think a daughter should look like their dad. And so I feel like, so I'm always aware of, like, I don't know what's sort of soaking into her head that she's going to one day sort of manifest. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So I'm aware of the fact that she's experiencing racism. She just can't name it yet. And, you know, I always talk about in airports, she likes to run in airports. So she'll just run and she'll get like, you know, if it's just in me and her hanging out together, she'll get like 20 feet in front of me and people will see this 2.5-year-old running and then they'll look around for the parent and they don't see the parent.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah.
And so because I'm a comedian, I have fun with that. And I look around like, yeah, I wonder where the parent is. Like, I sort of, like, my God, this 2.5-year-old is running. We have to really do something. And so I have fun watching people's reactions as they feel like, why is this 2.5-year-old by herself in the airport? Having said that, nobody's ever really made a big deal about it. They just go, I guess she's got to catch her flight. But at that level, it's like, I don't think racism starts when you're able to name it. Racism starts way before that.
Mm-hmm. So how are your concerns changing as your children get a little bit older?
You know, my daughter, Sammy, just started kindergarten and, you know, she's in a private school and it's a school that is very racially mixed. They, you know, they give you the percentages of the kids who identify as being not white. there's a lot of kids of color. For my money, there's not enough black kids, but that's just how I feel. You know, it's like, and so when she started school, my daughter has what I would say is classic mixed girl hair with like that huge, like giant light brown afro. And when she wears it out, she looks, you know, it's like this huge sculpture of hair. And it's amazing and it's fun. And so she would wear it out. And then she came home one day and said to my wife, Melissa, I don't want to wear my hair out anymore. And Melissa said, why? She said, because everybody touches it when it's out.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that's racism. When I had dreadlocks, I had a similar experience. People think they have access to touch you without asking. And that's racism. And now it is little kid racism, but it's still parents not teaching their kids not to touch other kids without asking. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so she's just sort of experienced like being standing around with her friends and somebody just suddenly grabbing her hair. And she doesn't like it. And part of me wants to sit her down and go, Sammy, this is racism. That's what you're experiencing. But she's not ready for that. So what I did was like I sort of swallowed hard and was like, all right, Sammy, if you don't want to wear your hair out, you don't have to wear your hair out. But just so you know, me and Melissa both said this, your hair is beautiful. We love it when it's out. And when you're ready to wear it out again, you can wear it out. So, you know, allowing her to have the agency to make her decision. And then over the course of several months, she wore it down. And then one day she's like, I want to wear my hair out again. And it, to me, it just felt like allowing her to make that decision in her own time. And also, there's a part of me that was like, no, you're wearing your hair out tomorrow and every day because we're going to teach these kids. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sort of allowing her to make those decisions while at the same time feeling like a gut punch at like she's 5 and she's already being affected by racism in a way that it's making her change her behavior.
Kamau, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. It's always great. It's an honor to be back.
W. Kamau Bell's new memoir is called The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. His CNN series, United Shades of America, airs on Sunday nights. Kendrick Lamar is one of the most widely admired performers in popular music today. His last collection, To Pimp a Butterfly, was named Album of the Year by many publications, including Billboard and Rolling Stone. His new album, called Damn, debuted at #1 on the Billboard album chart. Rock critic Ken Tucker says, Damn extends Lamar's range and the power of his storytelling.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, though ambition flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, and sworn like this, immaculate conception. I transform like this, perform like this, which yells you a new weapon. I don't contemplate, I meditate, then off your head. This that put the kids to bed. This that I got realness, I just kill shit.
Each song on Damn has a one-word title, is printed in capital letters, and each title ends with a period. It would seem to be Kendrick Lamar's way of announcing a theme with declarative boldness, that period implying the final word on the subject. Those subjects include, and these are song titles, love, lust, pride, fear, God, loyalty. Lamar knows that the best way to articulate an abstract concept is through specific illustrations, arguments, and examples. Listen to the way Lamar lists his worries and his cares on this song called Feel.
I
feel like a chip on my shoulders. I feel like I'm losing my focus. I feel like I'm losing my patience. I feel like my thoughts in the basement. I feel like you're miseducated. Feel like I don't wanna be bothered. I feel like you may be the problem. I feel like it ain't no tomorrow. The world, is ending. I'm done pretending. If you get offended, I feel like friends been overrated. I feel like the family been faking. I feel like the feelings are changing. Feel like my daughter compromised is jaded. Feel like you wanna scrutinize how I made it. Feel like I ain't feeling you all. Feel like removing myself, no feelings involved. I feel for you, I've been in the field for you. It's real for you, right? Shit, I feel like ain't nobody praying for me.
Kendrick Lamar began almost every line of that verse with the phrase, "I feel." That composition is what the New York School poet Kenneth Koch used to call a list poem. Lamar's verse talks about feeling misunderstood, impatient, put upon, besieged, and yet abandoned. There have been a lot of "fame is messing with my head" songs in pop music. "Feel" is one of the most vivid of them.
I wake in the morning, my head spinning from the last night. Both in a trance, feelings are dead, what a fast life. Manager called, the lobby call, it's 11:30. Did this before, promised myself I'd be an hour early. Room full of clothes, bag full of money, call it loose change. Bump on my jewelry, 100K, I lost a new chain. Hop on a bird, hit the next city for another M. Take me a nap, then do it again. We all woke up, trying to tune to the daily news. Looking for confirmation, hoping election wasn't true. All of us worried, all of us buried in our feelings deep. None of us married to his proposal, make us feel cheap. Stale and sad, distraught and mad, tell a neighbor about it. Bet they agree, parade the streets with your voice proudly. Time passed and things changed, reverting back to our daily program. Stuck in our ways, lust. Lately I feel like I've been lusting over the fame. Lately we lust on the same routine of shame. Lately my lust been heightened. Lately it's all contradiction. Lately I'm not here. Lately I lust over self. Lust turn into fear. Lately in James 4:4 it says, friend of the world is enemy of the Lord. Brace yourself. Lust is all yours.
Need some water.
I like the way Lamar's voice in that song, Lust, frequently ascends to a falsetto that reminds me of Curtis Mayfield's. And like Mayfield, Lamar is adept at making emotions such as lust and love serve as metaphors for social and political struggles. In Lust, he has a line about waking up one morning and, quote, hoping the election wasn't true. There are a couple of times on this album when he samples voices from the Fox News Channel, one of them specifically criticizing the lyrics of Lamar's music. The toughest music on this album is a blunt answer to such criticism, a refusal to back down. The range here is prodigious. He uses the croon of U2's Bono on a lamentation for America called XXX. And the song called Love is just plain remarkable. Listen to the way toward the end of the verse he executes his version of pentameter. 5 fast syllables, the end of each line, dropping an octave.
If I didn't ride blade on curve, would you still
love me?
If I'm in my mind at work, would you still
love me?
Keep it 100, I'd rather you trust me than to
love me.
Keep it a whole 100, don't got you, I got nothing. Hey,
I got something.
Hold up.
We gon' function,
no assumptions. Feeling like Tyson with it. Knock it out twice, I'm with it. Only for the night, I'm kidding. Only for life, yeah, only for life, yeah, only for life, let's get it. Hit that shoulder lean, I know what coming over me. Backstroke oversee, I know what you need. Already on 10, all money come in, all feeling go out, this feeling don't drought, this party won't end. If I didn't ride blade on curve, would you still?
In a recent interview, Lamar said that while his previous album, To Pimp a Butterfly, was about changing the world, the implied message of Damn is, I can't change the world unless I change myself. Listening to Kendrick Lamar tussle with his ideas about how to affect that change in himself can make you think about your own life and perhaps the things we can change.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. Our guests today are veteran journalists who spent years writing evocative profiles of people they typically never met. Marguerite Fox and Bruce Weber have each written more than 1,000 obituaries for the New York Times. Their subjects have ranged from celebrities and politicians to, as you'll soon hear, the inventor of stovetop stuffing. Fox and Weber are among those featured in a new documentary about the Times obituary department called Obit. It's directed by Vanessa Gould. Marguerite Fox joined the obituary desk in 2004 after working as an editor at the Times Book Review. She's trained as a cellist and a linguist. She still writes for The Times, writing advance obituaries of notable people for future use. Bruce Weber has worked as a Metro reporter and theater critic, among other roles at The Times, and is the author of several books. He's left the paper and is working on a biography of E.L. Doctorow, one of his obituary subjects at The Times. Bruce Weber and Margalit Fox spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Margalit Fox, Bruce Weber, welcome to Fresh Air. This is an interesting job that you both had for so many years, and some people might think it might be sad or morbid to write about people dying every day. Is it?
Not in the least. It may be a little bit contrary to popular belief, but in point of fact, in a news obituary of 800 or 1,000 words, there might be one or two sentences about the death, and the other 98% of this remarkable narrative is every inch about the life.
Well, I mean, there are melancholy aspects to it, I would say that. I mean, you know, you do often have to call families of the deceased at, you know, at a moment of their grieving. You know, that can sometimes be a little poignant. But I think Margot's right that, you know, it's a piece of journalism. We don't feel as though we're recording deaths so much as we are celebrating achievements or moments in history, that kind of thing.
Let's talk about the process of writing an obituary. Take a typical day. You get an assignment when you come in the morning. What's the day like?
Well, usually after I say hello to my colleagues, it would be, okay, so who's dead? In some form. And one of the editors who get in before the writers and have been scouring the wire service reports and the emails that have come in alerting us to various deaths and the Social Security rolls for possible subjects, they will already have met and decided who is going to be writing about which subject on that particular day. So I might come in and say, so what fresh hell do you have for me today? And there will be a folder with my fresh hell for the day, at which point you start doing your research. And then by the middle of the afternoon or earlier than that, you hope you're writing because, you know, the deadline right about, you know, Margot always says 6 o'clock. We can stretch it a little beyond that, but not too much beyond that.
Now, all this said, death, of course, is never solicitous of deadline, and many is the time that each one of us has had one arm in the coat sleeve ready to go home at 6 or 7 o'clock, and an editor sees something come across the wire service or somebody comes over to alert us to a death, and the editor comes over with the sheets of clippings and says, sit back down, and then you have maybe an hour to do all of this.
Yeah, those are bad days.
I bet. You spend a lot of time interviewing people, but I suppose you begin by reading clips on the person that you're learning about, and not all of that is on the internet. And there's literally a morgue of old newspaper clippings that newspapers that they maintain. And there's a couple of wonderful moments in the documentary in which we meet Jeff Roth, who maintains the Clips Morgue at the New York Times. Let's listen to a bit of this.
So this is the Times morgue. At the height of it, it was manned by 30 people, now one person. 3 shifts a day, 7 days a week, almost 24 hours till 3 a.m. We had the cutters, the indexers, the filers, the refilers. We clipped from about 28 different publications, along with the Times. Before we moved, there were approximately 10,000 drawers of clippings. If it went into the new Times building, all the floors would pancake. It couldn't stand the weight. So how much have I actually seen here? Virtually nothing. I mean, it's not even a question. I mean, look. I mean, how could you read all that? It's just one drawer. There's thousands of those drawers. And it's just, it's impossible.
And that is Jeff Roth of the New York Times from the new documentary about the Times obituary department called Obit. We're speaking with two veteran obituary writers, Bruce Weber and Margalit Fox. So I gather from what Jeff Roth, who's a wonderful guy to listen to, you must enjoy working with him.
Well, Jeff is a genius eccentric. I mean, he's He couldn't be more fun to be around. He seems to know everything. I mean, from every time I had to write an obituary of an obscure rock and roll drummer from the late 1960s, Jeff would bring me from his personal collection all of the album covers that the guy played on. So it was, this happened regularly. I mean, it was not a one-time event.
And the same is true irrespective of what field you're writing in. If it's, an old comic book artist, a novelist, you name it, he's a true postmodern Renaissance man. And the only hazard in that for us, the writer, is he's so wildly enthusiastic, loads you up with stuff. You got to read this, you got to read that, you got to call these five people. And you say, Jeff, I have to file the story by 6 o'clock.
So someone, you make a request and someone brings over an old brown envelope with clippings?
That's right. As you see in the film, our stalwart news clerk, Dan Slotnick, goes to the morgue, which is just a few doors down from us, a few doors east of us on 40th Street. So it's just a two-minute walk, but he does have to do it in all weathers.
And talk about opening these folders and looking at those clips. How important are they?
Well, it's Margot uses the word lovingly in the film to describe how we handle them. I mean, there really is, I don't know why this is, but reading old clips from the Times somehow is more informative than reading the digital version that you can find on the web. That somehow, you've got the picture next to it. Sometimes you've got an advertisement next to the story that places the time period in context. You open one of these folders with all of these clips in it, and yellowed clippings from the 1950s or the 1960s, and suddenly you're back there. In your own head, you're back there, which doesn't happen when you look up the stuff on the web.
That's right. And when we did move to our new skyscraper in 2007, some bean counter at the paper who had probably never read a newspaper in his life said, oh, well, we're going to disband the morgue. It's too expensive to bring it over. The usual kind of economy. And we, in Obits in particular, put up a hue and cry and threatened to lie down in front of any truck that was going to take our morgue away, because their argument that, oh, well, you can get everything electronically now, absolutely doesn't hold water for us. There are treasures in those morgue files, old press releases, old telegrams, old cast biographies from Playbill that a morgue attendant or some editor thought was worth filing. And there are things that will never be seen again electronically.
You write a lot about powerful and influential people. Do their relatives or associates or staff try and spin you?
Absolutely. And one of the fascinating things in doing this job is people who have been in the public eye all their life, politicians, Hollywood stars, have a publicist. And so they will get this one last act of spin control, even in death, which I find fascinating. You can take it with you, and we will get glossy press kits about the dear departed.
Sometimes the families are pretty activist. I've had wives and brothers call me to make sure that I was including something and not including something else. I wrote a lot about writers and performers, and there were several occasions on which I included dreadful reviews, and because the reviews themselves were famous, and that resulted in quite a bit of blowback from family and friends. Why did you have to bring that up in the obituary? That kind of thing.
We will very often come in the day an obit runs to the voicemail light on our phone and screaming invective from a family member calling us bad journalists, calling us every name in the book. And when you calm yourself down and steel yourself to listen to the voicemail again, because if you've made a mistake, it has to be corrected, you realize that the family member is not identifying any objective, correctable matter of fact that you've gotten wrong. It's simply that they wanted a eulogy, and what they got instead was a balanced news article.
Some famous people have obituaries that are pre-written. We learn in the documentary 1,700, I believe, have been done.
I think it might be up to 1,800 now.
Okay, so they're still working on them. And Margalit, now you're this is primarily what you do now, I gather.
This is primarily what I do. After 13 happy but frenetic years in the trenches, writing the kind of daily obit that we see Bruce and Paul Vitello do in the documentary, and that's what gives you gray hairs and high blood pressure, I very happily last summer made an arrangement with the paper to do only the kinds of obits that are written in advance. So I still write every day, but I'm not beholden to the ticking clock and the 6 o'clock deadline the way I was on daily for 13 years. So I have many fewer bylines, but my blood pressure literally went down about 30 points.
I'm going to ask each of you if you can think of an obituary. And I know this is hard because you've both done, what, 1,000 of these or something like that?
Something like that.
At least.
One that is memorable in some way because you love the lead or, I don't know, something that was particularly noteworthy about it. Margalit, something come to mind?
Well, the kind of person that obit writers love best are not the presidents and kings and the people in the history books, because while important, everybody knows what they did already. The kind of person we love best are these unsung backstage players, the men and women who are by no means household names, but who nevertheless did something that changed the world. And I think one of my favorite subjects was a Holocaust survivor who was a Hungarian named Laszlo Buch. He survived Auschwitz, came to this country, Americanized his name to Leslie Buck, worked for a paper cup company. Well, one day back at mid-century, he realized that his clients were Greek coffee shop owners in New York. So what did he do? He designed a paper cup with a Grecian theme, with the Greek urn going down the side and the three little golden coffee cups and the words, "We are happy to serve you." And that cup, which was known as the Anthora, became an emblem of New York City. It was copied. You could get the likeness of it on T-shirts. It was in Kojak and Law and Order practically every week. And it was the cup that New Yorkers drank their takeout coffee from for generations. And it can be traced back to one man having an idea in 1950-something, and the Times liked the story so much they put it on the front page.
I'm going to contradict something Margot just said, because my favorite obituary, not necessarily my most memorable one, but my favorite was Yogi Berra. I grew up as a Yankee fan with Yogi, and of course he was not only one of the great ball players of in Yankee history and in baseball history, but he was also one of the great characters. And the paper let me run long with the obit. They ran it, I think, at close to 4,000 words, and it got a wonderful amount of attention. And the reader mail was hilarious, and it was very satisfying, and it was really a lot of fun to write. So there was that one, and then the other memorable ones were the celebrities who died unexpectedly, the well-known people who died unexpectedly. I'm thinking of Philip Seymour Hoffman,
right,
who was found dead on Super Bowl Sunday, David Foster Wallace, who took his own life, and maybe most alarmingly and most vividly for me, David Carr, who died in the Times newsroom at 9 o'clock at night. I had a completed obituary at 11:59. It was the most frenetic 2 hours in my 30 years at the New York Times.
You've both done a lot of things besides write obituaries, including writing books. Margalit, you're trained as a linguist and you've written books, and Bruce, you wrote this book about umpires and about riding a bike across the country and other things. I'm wondering how writing so many obituaries has affected you. Do you think more about your own mortality?
Well, it's interesting. Most people say yes. I am adamant in the other direction. We invariably get that question in any interviews we do. And I would smack my hand on the table if I could get away with it just now and say, this is the worst kind of determinism and must be stopped. It would never occur to anyone to ask a dance writer, do you pirouette down the hall on your way to work every day? Or to ask a Wall Street reporter, do you shake out your piggy bank and count the coins each night? Likewise, no one should even think of asking an obit writer, do you think about death all the time? Because as I hope we and the film have made clear, it's almost never about death. It's about the life.
Bruce? Margot's answer is far more sophisticated and thoughtful than mine would be, which is, you know, exactly the opposite. I think about mortality all the time.
You're older than I am. What,
and more since you wrote all these obituaries?
I mean, I think so. I think it's a good thing that, I mean, the obits department at the Times is far and away the oldest in the paper. I mean, the oldest in terms of average age of the people who are in it. And I think that's appropriate because we've lived through a lot of the history that the people we're writing about have made. So we have that perspective. But I also think that one of the things that happens in when you're writing obituaries is that you get to, you know, it's the daily assessment of a life that kind of lands on you. The idea that you are making a judgment on what deserves to be remembered. And I don't think you can help turning that light back on yourself and wonder about your own life and what about it deserves to be remembered. So I'm okay with the question, Dave, even if even if Margot was not.
Oh, I like the question, but it just makes me cranky.
Well, Bruce Weber and Margalit Fox, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Our pleasure, man.
Bruce Weber and Margalit Fox are featured in the new documentary Obit about the New York Times obituary desk. They spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.